Good morning, everybody. Good morning, all you magnificent melonheads of the world. Happy Tuesday, everybody. Today's October 14th, 2025, and the trade war is back on. So much for that whole taco trade thing we were talking about yesterday. Well, this morning, the Chinese are, well, they woke up and chose economic violence. We've got the Chinese have placed sanctions on U.S. units of Hanwha Ocean. That is a South Korean shipbuilding conglomerate and the U.S. interests thereof. And the Chinese are out there saying, you know what, if you want to do any business with us, if you want to ship out of our ports, well, you're going to have to stop doing business with the United States. I suspect that South Koreans are going to tell them where to put it. That's a significant thing going on this morning here. Look, the trade war Friday was all the rage. We had that big sell-off in the market Friday afternoon when the Chinese announced restrictions on rare earths, and then President Trump says 100% tariffs. That sent crypto crashing. Crypto recovered from that crash. Everybody said taco. There was some softening of the rhetoric on Sunday night into yesterday. Now this morning, we are escalating again. And of course, everybody's probably watching Truth Social with a little bit of a cringe. You just know something's coming. And it's probably going to be full of all caps when the president starts typing this morning, just as soon as he finishes his Diet Coke and finds his phone. It's going to be messy today, guys. Now, why are they going after shipbuilding? Well, because this is a transition to a wartime economy. We're watching it. Everybody has been watching the U.S. government take stakes in rare earth companies and U.S. steel and Intel and saying, oh, my God, it's socialism and all these other things. Yeah, there are socialist connotations to that, but that's not what that is. Donald Trump is not interested in work or ownership of the means of production. Trust me. But that is the United States transitioning to a wartime economy where the government supports vital interests pertaining to the defense industry that can't stand on their own because they need to prop up those industries for when they need them, which most military academics say will be sometime in 2027. Oh, crap, that's like a year and a half from now, not even. So shipbuilding is a big one. That's one of those vital industries like chips, like rare earths, like medicine that the United States is way too dependent on the Chinese for. The Chinese have a huge stranglehold in shipbuilding. They're the biggest shipbuilder in the world. The second biggest is the South Koreans. So it's not an accident that the Chinese are targeting the South Korean shipbuilding industry today. And the United States has a major disadvantage in shipbuilding. The Chinese can put 300 new boats on the water for every one new boat the United States launches. That is not a typographical error, a 300-to-1 shipbuilding advantage. It's nothing to sneeze at. In World War II, the United States had something more akin to a 6-to-1 shipbuilding advantage over the Japanese, and we were able to overwhelm them with numbers in the Pacific. That was a 6-to-1 advantage. What the hell do you think a 300-to-1 advantage is going to look like? Although subtle differences, the U.S. shipbuilding infrastructure was far away from the front lines in World War II, whereas in China, their shipbuilding interests will be right on the front lines with a big fat bullseye painted on their heads. But still, a 300-to-1 shipbuilding advantage is huge. The U.S. is trying to close that gap, and the Chinese are not just going to sit idly by while it happens. They're going to use anything and everything at their disposal to stop that from happening. This is a transition to a wartime economy, guys. It's scary. There's still time to stop it, but it really looks like this is happening. Now, the Chinese are also targeting rare earths. Once again, we got a story in Reuters that says starting in September, as in a month and a half ago, the Chinese started dragging their feet when it came to issuing export licenses for rare earths. This was a month and a half before this latest little spat and all this stuff about, hey, you know, now we're not going to send you the rare earths. And this was back when the Chinese had told us, don't worry, we're going to expedite these licenses because of trade deals and big, beautiful negotiations. It's almost like you can't trust anything the Chinese say at the negotiating table. And, well, I guess, can you blame them? It's not like we are playing a consistent tune either at the negotiating table. Again, you guys, you can see where this is going. Things are so predictably treacherous and backstabbing is rampant. And, of course, the singular focus of the entirety of the Chinese economy for the last several decades has been military preparation for the inevitable invasion of Taiwan. It's not a bluff. They're going. This is going to happen, and it's going to suck for everybody. But I digress. What else we got this morning? China has placed export controls over Nexperian. That is the Chinese-owned Dutch chip maker. Is that accurate? Yeah. It's a Chinese company, but they have operations in the Netherlands. Yesterday, the Dutch government seized those operations, said Chinese CEO, you're out of here, at the behest of the U.S. government, by the way. And then today, the Chinese, again, they're not just taking that line down. They're saying, okay, no problem. You're going to take our stuff. We're not going to give Nexperia the stuff they need to make the chips that you say you need for your auto industry. Again, the trade war is ripping this morning, and that has reignited the sell-off in cryptocurrency. I did a video on Sunday about that big Friday sell-off, some of the suspicious trading activity surrounding it. It was all ignited by the threat of tariffs. This morning, the threat of tariffs and the threat of the trade war escalation is back. Bitcoin is selling off once again. And once again, there is some suspicious trading taking place around this announcement. That same whale who made hundreds of millions of dollars last week front-running that tariff announcement, well, he put his shorts back on Sunday. And here he is making bank this morning. Maybe somebody want to look into that? Fraud is becoming rather rampant, guys. They insider trade the Nobel Peace Prize, for crying out loud, these days. Also going on this morning, we have got the silver market is finally cooling off a little bit after hitting a new record yesterday. We've got prices are down a little bit here. Is this Mr. Slammy? Is this a price slam? Is this the end of the bull run? I don't think so, but let's not expect things to go up in a straight line. We've got spot. The last time I looked was down about $1.75. The front month contract in New York was down about $1. So silver's retreating here a little bit. But one thing I'm noticing, the retail enthusiasm for physical metal in the last couple of days, and specifically over the weekend and these first few days this week, we are seeing it come ripping back. I see Yankee Stacking doing a video, and people are lined up around the corner at Tim Marsh's store. I've got stories about dealers in Japan are shutting down. I've got stories about retail enthusiasm in Australia, in the UK. It seems there is a little bit of FOMO buying starting in the physical silver market. But again, it's still dominated by sellers. We have had stories about refiners are no longer buying sterling. They're no longer buying the 90% junk silver. Be on the lookout for great deals in constitutional, by the way, guys. If the refiners aren't buying it and people are still selling it in droves, that means the dealers are probably going to have to lower their prices. And they're already pretty low, even though the spot price has gone up. The premiums have been way down. This morning, we also got bank earnings, and they were actually pretty good. We got big banks, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, Citi. BlackRock's not a bank, but we'll lump them in there. Did I mention Goldman Sachs? They're also in there. You know what? They were all pretty good. The earnings are up, and it's not surprising. One thing that was very noteworthy this morning, JP Morgan posted a bigger provision for credit losses than people were expecting. That's not surprising, though, considering what happened at Tricolor. JP Morgan was one of the banks that took a big hit from Tricolor. We'll talk about just how big that hit was. Goldman's making a killing on trading and all the volatility in markets. But the real issue, guys, it was never the big banks I was worried about. It's the small banks and the regional banks that we need to be on the watch for this earnings season. That subprime auto credit, which there's really no such thing as subprime credit, because in 2022, they were all subprime because credit scores were useless, as my friend Lox Ganapathy from Unicus Research pointed out in some videos we've done over the last few months. So watch those small and regional bank earnings. Case in point, Julius Baer is a small Swiss bank, and they are out reporting a $58 million in losses from the collapse of Degag Capital in Germany. That's a small Swiss bank taking a big hit from a German real estate firm who lost a whole bunch of money in commercial real estate. So as usual, I'm not surprised to see good big bank earnings. The stocks are having mixed reactions to that. That is also going on this morning. We're going to go real fast through the big bank earnings. We have General Motors is taking a $1.6 billion hit from electric vehicles and from their scaling back of electric vehicles. That's a big impairment charge as well as some cash charges on their quarterly earnings, and they're warning about more hits in the future. We've got J&J is in the news here. They reported pretty strong earnings, and they're also spinning off their orthopedics units now. That would be the second major spinoff from J&J since 2023. We've got a healthcare conglomerate is starting to shed business units and get leaner and smaller. That's interesting. We'll talk about that one towards the end of the show. Guys, we got a lot to talk about this morning. How about we shrink my big melon of a head and let's see what is going on in the world of finance this morning. As always, don't forget that like button. And you new guys, hit that subscribe button right next to it so you can come back tomorrow and have your coffee with the melon heads, because we do this every single morning. And right now, the S&P 500 is down about 58 points or 0.87% lower, almost certainly on the heels of this news of the escalation in the trade war. The market was up yesterday. It was up pretty big on the, the market caught a whiff of taco. Everybody thought the rhetoric was softening after the Friday sell-off. Nope, not happening. Back to your trade war hysteria this morning. The Dow is down by 321 points or 0.7% lower ahead of the open. And the NASDAQ is down 281 points, 1.14% lower ahead of the opening bell. Stocks are down across the board, although I'd point out they are off their lows. The NASDAQ was down 400 points at the low this morning, so a little bit off of that level. We've got a stronger dollar again this morning, 99.33, up by 7 basis points. Keep an eye on things happening in Japan and things happening on France when it comes to the dollar. The Dixie strength, I don't think, has anything to do with the actual strength of the dollar relative to goods and services. It has more to do with the threat of even more obscene monetary debasement from the French and the Japanese. And that is why the dollar has strengthened over these last few weeks. Looking over at the bond market, it is open this morning, and we've got yields are moving a little bit lower here. The 30-year Treasury, 4.631. That's down a fraction of 1 point. The 10-year yield is off by 2 basis points at 4.036. The 2-year is at 3.497, off by 2.5 points. And the 1-month is at 4.086, down just a fraction of a point. Bitcoin is selling off again this morning, maybe not quite as ferociously as it sold off on Friday, but still significant. We're at $110,570 for Bitcoin. That is about $4,700 lower than yesterday. That is almost certainly being driven by this tariff news this morning. As always, guys, be careful on leverage. I do believe crypto winter began this weekend. I did a video about that one. If you want to check it out, look for the Night King in the thumbnail. And we've got some interesting stories here in Crypto News Australia. The whale who netted $200 million shorting crypto before Trump's tariffs bets against Bitcoin again. The same guy. You don't have to wonder. It's pretty freaking obvious what's happening here, that somebody is getting advance notice of these stories. Just as the crypto market seems to be regaining some ground after experiencing the worst crash in its history, some say nearly $1 trillion in market cap was lost, the whale who bet $200 million is going short again. On Sunday, that same wallet address added a $163 million 10x Bitcoin perpetual short. The position shows about $3.5 million in unrealized gains. Its stated liquidation level sits near $125,500. First of all, the wallet drew scrutiny for a prior short placed just 30 minutes prior to President Trump's tariff announcement on Friday. That move coincided with a sharp market crash and, by community estimates, produced $192 million in profit. The timing triggered insider whale allegations from traders. So it looks like this guy is back at it again, and there are some people speculating they know who it is. A note from blockchain researcher Connor Grogan linked the trader to a large Bitcoin holder that rotated sizable Bitcoin into Ethereum earlier this year. Separately, some market participants pointed to former Bit4x CEO Garrett Gin. Gin acknowledged a connection, but said the capital is clients' funds, not his personal money. Pseudonymous sleuth Ion Chains posted the Jin link on X over the weekend, and Binance founder Changpeng Zhou reshared it with "not sure of validity, hope someone can cross check." Guys, the fraud in crypto, it's reached a fever pitch, obviously. The insider trading here, the Trump family has a lot of connections to the crypto industry. I am not surprised to see this information leaking and that people are pre-positioning themselves. We're kind of getting desensitized to white-collar fraud and insider trading. It's not supposed to be like this. I know I sound ignorant and naive. Oh, yeah, that's adorable. But it's not supposed to work this way. Meanwhile, we've got the shiny is taking a breather this morning. Spot gold is at $4,111. That's up $1. All right, it is up. Spot gold is up and $4,100. Hey, that's pretty impressive. Meanwhile, the December front month gold contract is down $5 at 41.27. Check out that intraday high from the front month gold contract, 41.90. We almost hit 4,200 overnight. But for now, the metals are down. Silver is interesting this morning. We've got spot silver in London at $50.63. That's down by $1.73 or about 3.33%. Meanwhile, that front month silver contract at $49.55 is down about 88 cents or 1.75%. Guys, silver, this is pretty interesting. We've got an article about silver. We'll get to it in a minute. Let's just go through a little bit of the other commodities this morning. Copper down 3.5%. Platinum down 2.25%. Palladium down 0.33%. Metals down across the board here. Crude oil down 1.8% at $58.41. That's off by a dollar. Put a pin in oil. We'll be back to that one as well. But first, let's talk about silver here. We got this one in Bloomberg this morning. Silver falls as London market squeeze shows signs of easing. All right, it shows signs of easing. I would not signal the all clear just yet. Spot silver prices retreated after hitting an all-time high earlier Tuesday as a historic squeeze in London began to show signs of easing. Spot prices fell 1.6% after hitting a record $53.55 an ounce in London earlier Tuesday. Holy crap. That was about a dollar higher than the peak set in January of 1980. Concerns about a lack of liquidity in London have sparked a worldwide hunt for silver, with benchmark prices soaring to near unprecedented levels over New York. That's prompting some traders to book cargo slots on transatlantic flights for silver bars, an expensive mode of transport typically reserved for gold, to profit off higher prices in London. Those silver bars will start arriving in the coming weeks, multiple traders said, and the arbitrage trading has already substantially eroded the premium. The gap fell to about 80 cents an ounce on Tuesday, down from a spread of as much as $3 last week. Currently sits around a dollar. So look, the enthusiasm in London, the squeeze, it's tapered off a little bit here, guys, but this is a very slight pullback, not the slam many are expecting. And there's also some noteworthy things to keep an eye on. This is the cost to borrow shares of the SLV, which is one indicator of the tightness in London. It's still 11.3%. That is astronomically high. It's not as high as the 14.3% we hit yesterday. So the cost to borrow SLV is down, but you'll notice zero shares available at that price, which means if you want to borrow shares, they're going to get more expensive. It goes to show you, even though prices are down here, the situation in London is still a mess. London is a hot mess. And the retail enthusiasm is coming back as well. Shout out to Bai Xiaojun, who is at Oriental Ghost on X, who posted this one here. I'm probably going to butcher some of the pronunciation. Forgive me, sir. Shuibei Market's largest online trading platform, Rongtong Gold, has stopped selling silver sheets. China's largest e-commerce, JD.com, has almost all merchants taking down raw silver. Only one is for sale with a price of $108.25 an ounce. The small raw bar is $1.28.50 an ounce. Oh my God, those prices, by the way. Nobody, guys, if you see a price, do not pay that price. All right. This is starting to look a little bit what's happening with these Chinese platforms, starting to look a little bit like 2021. Where there's nothing available, they jack up the premiums and people start FOMOing in. Not sure that's what's going on here, but this is indicative. We've seen stories like this in Japan, stories like this in India, stories like this in Australia, in the UK, some anecdotes in the States about retail buyers coming back to the physical market. So we're starting to see signs of that. It could be indicative that we're starting to enter the late stages of this rally. That's just something to keep an eye on here. But some of those prices, I hope nobody's paying those prices. All right. And certainly not the melon heads. Nobody's paying $1.20 or $128.50 for an ounce of silver. All right. Now, we also talked about oil in the commodities. Check this one out this morning. Shout out to Mish who caught this one. Good catch, Mish. IEA raises its estimate for record oil oversupply in 2026. Remember that video I did a few weeks ago about Chinese overcapacity? Chinese are starting to shut down a lot of their extra solar and their industrial and their mining capacity. And by default, that means they're using less oil. We're starting to see oil pile up in boats sitting on the water. And that's as buyers reduce their orders and sellers keep producing more oil. We have an oversupplied market. A record oversupply of oil will be bigger than previously estimated, and the excess is already starting to build up on ocean-going tankers, the International Energy Agency said. World oil supply will exceed demand by almost 4 million barrels a day next year, an unprecedented overhang in annual terms, the IEA said in its latest monthly report. It predicted surplus is up roughly 18% from last month's estimate as the OPEC Plus alliance continues to revive output and the outlook for the group's rivals in 2026 strengthens. While inventories have piled up at a brisk clip of 1.9 million barrels a day this year, their impact on prices has been mitigated by China scooping up the majority, according to the report. That's beginning to change as a surge in Middle East exports pushes the volume of oil on the water to the highest level in years. Looking ahead, as the significant volumes of crude oil on water move onshore to major oil hubs, crude looks set to surge, the Paris-based energy advisor to major economies said. By the way, he's saying crude looks set to surge. I think he means crude supply looks set to surge here, because I don't think this means surging prices by any measure. This means collapsing prices. It trimmed consumption growth estimates slightly for this year and boosted non-OPEC supply estimates for this year and next. The surplus is building as demand growth in China and other key consumers cools, while the OPEC Plus alliance revives halted production and the group's rivals in the Americas continues to expand rapidly. Crude futures are trading near $63 a barrel in London, down 15% for the year. So be careful, you oil investors out there, guys. Oil starting to pile up in boats. I don't think this is 2020 crisis levels. I don't think we're going to see prices go negative here, but we are going to see production get curtailed at some point as supply keeps increasing and demand keeps reducing. We know how this ends. We know what that means for prices. All right, let's talk about the big one this morning. China escalates U.S. trade fight with curbs on shipping. This one in Bloomberg. China sanctioned the U.S. units of a South Korean shipping giant and threatened further retaliatory measures on the industry, the latest in a series of tit-for-tat moves as Beijing and Washington jockey for leverage before expected trade talks. The sanctions targeting five U.S. units of Hanwha Ocean Co. helped fuel a slump in global equities on Tuesday as traders dialed back hopes for an easing of tensions between the world's largest economies. Hanwha Ocean closed down 6.2% while shares of Chinese shipbuilders rallied. China's moves escalate a longstanding dispute with the U.S. over maritime dominance. Both sides have already slapped special port fees on each other's vessels, while the U.S. has rallied allies, especially South Korea, to help it revive a moribund American shipbuilding industry. The battle has implications for the global economy as vessels are responsible for moving more than 80% of international trade. Over the past decade, Chinese shipbuilders have outperformed their South Korean and Japanese counterparts to become the world's top vessel makers, doing so while America's industry was nearly non-existent. The Trump administration's push to revive U.S. shipbuilding offered South Korean players a perch to expand their influence, with Seoul pledging to commit $150 billion in expertise and investments to stimulate U.S. ambitions in the sector. I would add that deal has not been finalized, that $150 billion for U.S. shipbuilding. Right now, it's hung up in negotiations while the U.S. and South Korea figure out what to do about the 4X requirements. It's probably going to end up with the U.S. Treasury offering a big swap line to the South Koreans in order for them to get their hands on the dollars to invest in our shipbuilding industry without crashing their own currency. In March, as Washington was deliberating on the final shape and form of the actions it would take against China's shipping prowess, Hanwha Shipping submitted public comments to trade representative Jameson Greer in support of the probe. China's latest measures will put pressure on South Korea to choose between Beijing and Washington, according to Jung In-yoon, chief executive officer of Fibonacci Asset Management. The sanctions against Hanwha send a clear message from Beijing, Yoon added, noting if the Korean company continues to work with the U.S., it will have to sacrifice its Chinese business. And look, guys, that last sentence there, like, oh, we can't lose our Chinese business. Guys, when this thing lights off in the South China Sea, what do you think is going to happen to Chinese business? What do you think is going to happen to the rare earth market and to the chips market when the missiles start crossing the Taiwan Strait? You think we're still going to be able to get this stuff? All the people who are out there are like, oh, my God, this trade war with the Chinese, it's so insane. It is freaking inevitable. The Chinese have shown us with their actions what they're going to do. And do you think the South Koreans, who have lived under the constant threat of North Korean artillery financed by the Chinese for the last, 75 years, Do you think they're about to be like, oh, okay, we'll abandon the United States because we're afraid of what China might do? No. This is battle lines being drawn, guys. This is a shift to a World War III economy. And it also affects the rare earths this morning. China is making it harder to get rare earth magnet export license, sources say. Now, this one was just updated a few hours ago, but it looks like this story started weeks ago. Chinese rare earth magnet companies have been facing tighter scrutiny on export license applications since September, sources say, even before Beijing's move last week to expand control over the critical minerals used in magnets. The lengthier reviews magnet makers face raise questions about whether China, the top global supplier, is seeking to throttle back magnet shipments, contrary to its commitment to speed up exports in a trade truce with the U.S. in May to further tighten its grip on the products essential in military and commercial technology. It's almost like you can't trust a word they say. That's interesting. They told us they were going to speed up export licenses, and they didn't. They slowed them down, and now they're threatening to not issue them at all. Again, the whole like taco trade yesterday didn't make a lot of sense to me, today it still doesn't make a lot of sense. And the Chinese are pissed about what the Dutch did yesterday as well. China puts export controls on Nexperia after the Dutch takeover. We talked about that Dutch takeover in the live stream yesterday, and we said, of course, the Chinese wouldn't take it lying down. They're not. China is blocking Nexperia from exporting products from the Asian nation after the Dutch government moved to seize control of the chip maker. China retaliated after the Dutch government invoked a Cold War era law to take control of Nexperia to ensure Europe retains access to its products. The company is a subsidiary of China's Wingtech Technology and a key supplier of mature chips used by the automotive and consumer electronics industry. The Chinese Ministry of Commerce issued an export control notice earlier this month prohibiting Nexperia China and its subcontractors from exporting some components. The company said in a statement on Tuesday, Nexperia said it is trying to obtain an exemption. Beijing's retaliation shows how tensions are ratcheting up between China and Europe, leading into high-stakes trade talks with the U.S. U.S. President Trump and Chinese leader Xi Jinping are set to meet to hammer out a trade accord this month, with both sides announcing restrictions in the run-up. I would not be surprised to see that summit get canceled at this point. If both sides keep escalating at some point, either Trump or Xi is going to throw a fit, and they're going to say, you know what, let's not meet. Let's just do this thing. All right, we got bank earnings this morning. We got a lot of bank earnings, and we're going to blow right through it. I'll touch on the key points here. JP Morgan Chase tops estimates as trading revenue hits a record of nearly $9 billion. JP Morgan's earnings were very good here, but the one thing I want to draw attention to all the way down at the bottom of CNBC, because they always bury the bad news, JP Morgan's provision for credit losses rose 9% to $3.4 billion. Exceeding the $3.08 billion estimate, indicating that the firm's preparing for higher loan defaults down the road. That's important. I wasn't really expecting a big one from the big banks and loan provisions, but JP Morgan was exposed to the Tricolor bankruptcy. They had about $200 million. The initial report said three banks, Fifth Third, Barclays, and JP Morgan were all on the hook for about $200 million in losses. And we got confirmation of that one today. Tricolor contributed $170 million charge-off to JP Morgan's costs. So, you know, they're clarifying here the initial estimate was $200 million. It came in a little bit below that. So I'm not surprised to see that decline in JP Morgan's, or that big increase in JP Morgan's provisions for credit losses. I am surprised to see no mention of provisions for credit losses in any of the other bank earnings this morning, at least not in any of the articles about them. Watch for that with the regional banks. I think the regional banks are more exposed to commercial real estate and subprime auto and buy now, pay later debt. So it'll be a bigger deal over there. For now, JP Morgan stock is down 2.3% here, probably selling off along with the rest of the market. It's off by about $7, trading at $300.20. But keep in mind, year to date, JPM still up 25.5%. It's been a good year for the bank stocks. We also got Wells Fargo raised their return targets after the asset cap was lifted and they beat their profit estimates. That's pretty much the whole story there. JP Morgan finally got some relief from several years worth of penalties because of their fake account scandal from years ago. They reported pretty good earnings, and Wells Fargo stock doing pretty good here, up 4.2%. trading at $82.23. That's up by more than $3. And, you know, Wells Fargo's had a pretty good year, up 17% year to date, lagging JP Morgan somewhat, playing catch up this morning. Now, Goldman Sachs had a hell of a quarter. They topped estimates on better than expected investment banking and bond trading. All that volatility that we've seen around the trade war and, you know, yields moving up and down and people front running and hyperventilating over everything the Fed said. Goldman Sachs makes most of its money from investment banking. From the IPO market has loosened up a little bit. That helped them. So Goldman reported a pretty good quarter as well. But the stock is down 3.5% on this news. Seems to be no rhyme or reason to which direction the bank stocks trade this morning. Although year to date, Goldman has had a hell of a run, 32.5% higher year to date. All right. So you had JP Morgan and Wells Fargo, or JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs, both way up year to date. The stocks are down on good earnings. Wells Fargo was up year to date, but not nearly as much. They're up on good earnings. So maybe the big banks are just kind of leveling off here. We also got BlackRock earnings. Look, passive investment bubble continues. People just aimlessly pile money into the market. And that means BlackRock is taking in more money. That means their management fees are going up. They took in another $205 billion. And as always, keep an eye on that private asset story, guys. You know, putting people's retirement money into dog shit private credit and private equity assets. That remains a risk. BlackRock stock up 1.25% here this morning. Let's get an accurate mark. Yep, up 1.25%, trading at $1,170. And year to date, BlackRock is up 14.25%. All the big banks, big asset managers having a great year, getting a little bit better this morning. Not too surprising. Now, watch out for the little banks. Watch out for the regional banks. This story is a good indicator. Shout out to my friends at MacroEdge who drew my attention to this one. Julius Baer was key lender to collapsed German firm Degag. Julius Baer Group was a key lender to the German real estate group Degag Capital, which collapsed last year, owing almost 50 million euros or $58 million to the Swiss firm, said Handelsblatt in a report. The wealth manager filed 48 million euros in claims to Degag's insolvency administrator, according to the German newspaper, which cited a preliminary insolvency report. The amount exceeds the record profits Julius Baer attained from its German business in 2023. So 48 million euros, $58 million or so, may not seem like a big number, but for this relatively small bank, Julius Baer, that basically wipes out all their profit from 2023. So this is a pretty big deal. And it goes to show you the vulnerabilities in some of these markets, like real estate, like subprime consumer credit. It's the small banks that have the exposure. And that firm separately announced an increase in loan loss allowances to 130 million Swiss francs or $163 million related to clients in Switzerland and other European countries in May. It has significantly reduced certain selected positions across the mortgage book and the remaining private debt loan book since 2024, the bank said in a statement. Oh, look, mortgages, private credit. Who could have guessed that might be where the losses would be residing? Meanwhile, we've got GM takes a $1.6 billion charge on Trump-induced pullback from EVs. That's a silly title, Bloomberg. You're a silly organization. It is not a Trump-induced pullback from EVs. It is the world coming to its senses because Cathie Wood was full of shit and the world piled into EVs way too hard, way too fast. The market didn't want this. And you know what? The ESG movement and all the silly imbeciles in the financial press tried to jam this garbage down the throats of middle America where there isn't even a freaking charging station. People never wanted these things to begin with. People never wanted this whole silly industry. And go figure, nobody bought it. And now GM's taking a big loss. This wasn't Trump-induced. This was idiocy-induced. General Motors is incurring a $1.6 billion in charges related to paring back electric vehicle production plans, underscoring the toll on U.S. car makers from flagging federal support for plug-in vehicles. Non-cash impairment and other charges totaling $1.2 billion are the result of adjustments to EV capacity, GM said Tuesday in a regulatory filing. The rest of the costs relate to canceling contracts and settling commercial arrangements linked to EV investments and will have a cash impact. GM warned the reassessment of its EV manufacturing footprint is ongoing, and that it's reasonably possible it will recognize more charges that hurt its results in the quarters to come. They're not even done losing money on this stupidity. The automaker's shares fell 3.3% before the start of regular trading in New York. Now, GM is off its lows, and it's actually up now. That's interesting. Up a third of a percent, $55.86 on a $1.6 billion charge with more to come. And, well, GM is actually up 4.8% year to date. Be careful with this one, guys. The auto market is a mess. The auto finance market is even worse. And it's this whole auto industry has a very cash for clunkers vibe about it. Let's just say that. And last but not least, we've got J&J to spin off the orthopedics business and raise their full year forecast. But full disclosure, this is one I own. I have a small position in J&J. I've had it for years. They're getting smaller here. Johnson & Johnson on Tuesday said it plans to separate its orthopedics business into a standalone company named DePuy Synthes. Somebody tell me how do you pronounce that? DePuy, within the next 18 to 24 months, marking its second major spinoff since 2023. J&J's orthopedics unit, which makes hip, knee, and shoulder implants, surgical instruments, and other products, generated around $9.2 billion last year, or about 10% of total revenue. J&J in 2023 announced a two-year restructuring program for its orthopedics business, saying it planned to exit certain markets and stop selling some products after having recently spun off its $15 billion consumer unit into Kenvue. The company said it planned to focus on high-growth, high-margin areas as part of its separation plans, such as oncology, immunology, neuroscience, surgery, vision care, and cardiovascular. J&J also raised their 2025 sales forecast by about $300 million, now expects product revenue of $93.5 billion to $93.9 billion. That's above analyst expectations for $93.4 billion. Third quarter sales of $23.99 billion edged past Wall Street expectations of $23.77 billion. So it's a slight beat and raise for J&J. The stock not holding up so great here, 1.8% lower this morning. But I would point out, once again, year-to-date, J&J up almost 30%. So maybe a little bit of that positivity was already baked into the cake here. And I just want to say thank you so much to Mr. Gordon Guanu. Hey, Gordon, what's going on this morning, brother? He says, our Navy has two kinds of boats, submarines and targets. But building up to fight the last war creates jobs, I guess. Look, the last war on the water we've really fought was the Houthis. And although we won the battles, we did not achieve our objective. And the reason we didn't achieve our objective is we didn't have enough boats and we didn't have enough missiles to do the job. And the missiles we did have were too expensive. We need to get smaller, lighter, and more efficient. I hope the Navy learned its lessons from what we fought in the Houthis. Now, that being said, I'm going to go on the Shannon Joy podcast later today. She was nice enough to invite me on her podcast, and we were talking about this the other day. She, on the phone, she expressed worries about a draft, and she's worried about her sons. I don't really see this going that way. A war in the South China Sea is going to be an island-hopping campaign with a naval conflict happening behind it. We'll use islands with Marines and missiles on them as a shield to try to protect our carriers and our destroyers that are protecting Taiwan and defending the skies. As far as targets, you know, drones is going to be a big factor in the next fight. Hypersonic missiles is going to be a big factor. And the factory, all right? You know, I watched a video over the weekend all about some Japanese, like a lot of Japanese admirals and captains in their journal entries during the war in the Pacific. And slowly over the course of the war, they started to realize they weren't fighting a country, they were fighting a factory. And they couldn't win. They couldn't keep up with U.S. industrial capacity. Right now, that advantage is flipped. The Chinese have that industrial capacity advantage. So we should learn our lessons from the last war. We need to rebuild that defense industrial base, if nothing else, to make sure the fight doesn't happen. Because the second the Chinese think we can't keep up with them, they'll go. It'll be blood in the water. So the easiest way to make sure this war happens is to do nothing and to stay on the current course that we're on. So thank you, Gordon Guano, for supporting the channel. Dan Hedin says one caveat to that is that their boats are a littoral navy where ours is blue water. That is correct. They use the phrase a green water navy to describe most of China's fleet is small coastal patrol boats. That being said, China's got a very rapidly growing navy, and it's growing a hell of a lot faster than ours. Ours is better. Is it 300 times better? Probably not. They cannot project power away from Chinese waters as of now. That is also true. But I would point out, Dan, that they don't need to project power to take Taiwan because Taiwan would be a littoral war. It would be fought within a few hundred miles of China's coast, where China's Air Force and the PLARF, the People's Liberation Army Rocket Force, and its huge arsenal of ballistic and hypersonic cruise missiles will be available to target our ships and bases. So, yes, the Chinese cannot project power, but the Chinese don't need to project power. We need to project power. We need to overcome the tyranny of distance, be able to keep supply lines thousands of miles across the Pacific Ocean satisfied. And that's why logistics wins wars, ultimately. Good point, though, Dan. Thank you, sir, for supporting the channel. Nashville Pasta Man says, hope peace deal performs better than the China deal. Yeah, the China deal, not so good. Look, guys, I hate to be beating the war drum so much here, but it was pretty obvious in the beginning of 2022 what the Russians were going to do. They were spending huge amounts of money to put vast quantities of men and material in place along the border. It was so obvious what they were doing. And a lot of people were saying, oh, it's a conspiracy theory. You're getting too expensive. It's never going to happen. Calm down. Lighten up, Francis. I remember saying, guys, there's no way they're spending this much money and effort for nothing. This is not a bluff. They are going. And of course, they ended up going and we're still fighting that war. And I see the Chinese doing the same thing. Every single ferry that carries cars across a river between any two Chinese cities is built to military specifications to be able to handle armor to invade Taiwan. Every single civilian ferry is built to military specs for the purpose of invading Taiwan. They've been doing this for years. They're building huge amphibious docks that can roll up on the beach, drive these piles into the sand, and offload tanks onto the beach in Taiwan. They are spending billions on this. It's not a bluff. It's very likely to happen. And everything I have read has said 2027 is when they go. Thank you, Pasta Man, for supporting the channel. Chris Bott says the Chi Coms can outbuild us, but we have the Yellen. Ever see Mars Attacks? It'll be like that. I have seen Yellen. Are we going to send the 101st Yellen Brigade? I will lead my troops from the front lines into battle, where we will fight with a strong and resilient conviction. And crap, who am I kidding? I'll be collecting speaking fees. War is a young man's operation. That's when we send young men to die because old men can't get along. Yes, thank you very much, Secretary Yellen, for reminding us of that. And imagine Xi Jinping's terror at the thought of a Marpat camo clad Janet Yellen parachuting onto the South China Pacific. They're going to need to dig her out with bayonets if they want to get her off that island. Thank you very much, Chris Bott, for the laugh this morning. Big Mouth Barry says, welcome back, Doomers. Banks collapse in 2026? That's a little hint to the Doomers reunion that I did with my friends Travis and Melody yesterday, talking about the housing market. That story Melody told about that property, that's like $1.5 million property that's got almost $5 million in private loans against it. The multiple pledging of collateral to take out private mortgages from five different institutions, and none of them realize that the same collateral has been pledged in every instance. It's exactly what happened with Tricolor and First Brands. They're doing it with properties. And Melody says she sees it all the time. Oh, and then what Travis found with property tax fraud in Texas, where these people have been trying to sell their house for months at $173,000, and yet the assessed value for their property taxes is $333,000. That is wholesale theft. That is not just a tax on unrealized capital gains. That is a tax on imaginary capital gains, what they're doing to people with property taxes. Check out that video I did with my fellow Doomers yesterday. Thank you, Big Mouth Barry. Bank collapse in 2026. Define bank collapse. You know, 2008, probably not. 2023, plausible. I do think we could see another regional bank crisis like we saw in 2023. I think subprime auto could trigger it. Keep an eye on names like Carvana and Ally Financial, who bankrolls a lot of that crap. Also, the commercial real estate effects on small and regional banks, that's still out there, as well as the unrealized losses from declines in U.S. Treasury values. That's still on their balance sheets, you know, the whole 2023 thing. So we could see a replay of 2023, and in which case the big banks would get even bigger, gobbling up their small competitors. And I would also draw your attention to that merger of Fifth Third and Comerica that happened last week, or was it 2 weeks ago now? That was very interesting. That's two troubled banks merging together. That struck me as a very defensive acquisition, like hurry up and get too big to fail. Wouldn't be surprised to see more of that as well. Thank you very much, Big Mouth Barry, for supporting the channel, sir. And thank you, everybody, for having your coffee with the Melonheads this morning. Hey, don't forget that like button and that subscribe button for the YouTube algorithm. Thank you so much, everybody, for the super chats and for supporting the channel, as well as you magnanimous Melonheads on Patreon and YouTube members. Thank you so much for supporting the channel. Links down below, should you feel so inclined. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. Love you guys. Look for that interview on the Shannon Joy Show later today on Twitter and Spotify and Apple Podcasts, all that good stuff. And until next time, live small and dream big.